dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the battle spaces that seems to many to be a throwback to an earlier time, but is actually very much part of our own phase of this war for the free world, involves nuclear deterrence. A man who has thought and written and helped the rest of us understand much about this over many years is our first guest. He is Peter Husey. He is the president of Geostrategic Analysis. He's been a senior defense consultant to outfits like the Air Force Association. He is also a contributor to the Gatestone Institute, and we're particularly keen to pick his brains a little bit about topic that the president touched on, at least in passing, in the State of the Union address, namely the 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or INF Treaty. Had a small hand in negotiating it myself. I'm particularly keen to hear what Peter has to say about the president's decision that, in light of Russian violations of that accord, we must withdraw from it. Welcome, Peter. Good to have you with us.
And thank you, Frank, for all you do at the Center for Security Policy. And I appreciate talking with you this morning.
Good. Well, thank you. Let me talk to you about specifically the Russians' claim that no. It was the United States that has been violating this treaty all along. And if we now withdraw, they will go about building up nuclear forces that would otherwise be impermissible. What do you make of it?
Well, it's funny is that the Russians can come along and since 2010 violate the treaty. And by building land-based cruise missiles that have a range over 500 miles and below 5,000 miles. That's the law. It's not a nuclear treaty. It's actually a missile treaty. And they also said to the Bush administration back in 2006, let's get out of the INF treaty, which is not any good anymore. So they've been trying to push out of the treaty for years. And they just announced that they're now going to deploy two new missiles that are violations of the INF treaty, but since they're out of the treaty now, they're going to say, well, we can do this. Well, do you think they just went down to the local five and dime and bought themselves some missiles? As Mark Snyder points out, that the National Institute of Public Policy, they've been building these things already. So they've been in violation of the treaty for some time. The ironic thing is that the arms control termites, as I call them, the people who are so much always undermining our security, they're blaming America for this because as they have, Joser and Sione of Plowshares, for example, wrote, yes, the Russians are violating the INF, but just a little bit. And it's not really militarily significant. And someone wrote on War on the Rocks, which is a website, saying that a little bit of arms control is better than no arms control. So even though the Russians are violating the INF, they're not violating it wholesale. So we should stay in a treaty that the other guy is violating, which means you make a policy decision to unilaterally not do something that you're no longer denied to do. So that, I think, is number one. The most important thing, Frank, though, is since the INF treaty in 1987, it's been 30 years. What's the balance? In nuclear, the long-range nuclear weapons are under the START treaty. And the Russians have deployed probably around 2,500 of those warheads because they've taken advantage of the counting rules. We're still probably 1,600. So the arms race there is the Russians are engaging in it. We haven't got our sneakers on yet to get on the track. But more importantly, in theater systems, as you know, the Russians have at least 2,000 warheads, none of them under arms control. We have 200 deployed in Europe. So they have a 10-to-1 advantage already, meaning they've already gone around the track two or three times. We haven't got our sneakers on yet, as I said, and yet we're accused of starting an arms race in the theater nuclear area, which is what INF can deal with.
Yeah. Peter, I'm always appreciative of your clarity on the nature of the arms control community and the degree to which they are reflexively blaming America first and seeking to excuse our opponents and constrain us indefinitely, no matter what. And In this case, there's another factor that I just wanted you to touch on quickly, and that is a nation that is not covered by that now abandoned treaty. The Chinese have been building very aggressively missiles of the character that would be covered in this treaty. The president, in his State of the Union address, and sort of alluded to the possibility of renegotiating this to bring them in. Any prospect of that as you see it?
Well, it's interesting. The Russians have also said, well, if you want to keep the treaty, let's get the Chinese to come in. And the thing is, the Chinese have said, I think 2 days ago, they said, forget it. We don't want any part of it. And the Chinese are building probably in the total thousands of such missiles aimed at Taiwan, aimed at Guam, aimed at the Philippines and part of the South China Sea, which is in a dilemma on our part, because to defend that area with we can launch these cruise missiles from sea and we can do it from airplanes, but land is where you have the quickest bang for the buck. You can deploy them easily. They can have long range. And so we have a dilemma in dealing with China. But the most important issue here is some in Congress, particularly the chairman of the Armed Services Committee in the House, Mr. Smith, has now drafted, as I understand it, a defense bill before seeing even the president's proposal. And it would ban the first use of nuclear weapons by law. It would ban the production of the low-yield nuclear weapon and attaching it to the D-5 submarine-launched ballistic missile. And it would get rid of the money for the Space Force. The ones we're concerned about, the two, is that he would, under law, for the first time ever, a congressional committee would put into statute, which means law, a restriction on the use of nuclear weapons by a president. This is all based on the leftist argument that we have a president that's out of control, that's very impetuous, and he's going to wake up tomorrow and, you know, nuke Chad. And it's ridiculous beyond, I mean, no other president has been treated this way. And as someone, as a president who said, look, I have a deterrent, Mr. Kim, of North Korea, you don't, and we're not going to be pushed around any longer. Thank God he said that, because since 1953, the North Koreans have attacked us over and over and over again. They've grabbed the Pueblo. They've axe-murdered our people. They've shelled villages in South Korea. And I asked the former head of the CIA, Mike Morrell, I said, have we ever used military force against them in response? And he looked at me. We were at the Reagan Forum last December in California. And he said, no, we haven't. And he said, no wonder they think they can deter us. And what the president was saying is, my button, in the sense my deterrent, is going to deter North Korea. You're not going to take action to harm America anymore.
It seems unlikely that the president will go along with Adam Smith's proposal.
Well, the thing is, then you don't get a defense bill, Frank. That's the problem.
The problem, it may well be that they decide that they want, you know, denuclearization of the United States rather more than they want to protect our country with all manner of forces. Peter, just very quickly, you and Stephen Blank wrote a piece recently in Gatestone about rebalancing our forces, how we might augment deterrence in light of what the Russians and, for that matter, the Chinese are up to. Can you give us just the quickest of distilled essence of your recommendation?
Well, the three things you need to do. You need to do missile defense as called for by the Missile Defense Review regionally and nationally. You need to modernize our nuclear deterrent as called for the Nuclear Posture Review, and as the National Defense Review and the National Security Strategy Review both call for, we need to build those air defenses and conventional capabilities on offense, whether it's missiles, airplanes, or on submarine cruise missiles, so that we can get to the fight on time.
Peter, I hope you'll come back to us again with updates and reports. Thank you very much, Peter. We'll talk to you soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're joined, as we have the privilege of being most weeks, by Bill Gertz. He is the author of a prize-winning column at the Washington Times, Inside the Ring, required reading, Inside the Ring and elsewhere, of course. He is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon, an incredibly important online resource, and the author of seven best-selling books, including most recently I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age. He's a good friend, valued colleague, always glad to have him with us. Bill, welcome back.
Hi, good to be on the program.
Thank you so much for being so. We were talking a moment ago with Peter Husey about the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the INF Treaty, Bill, and you and I go way back to the days when it was being negotiated, and as I recall, we both had some concerns that it would be violated by the Russians, and here we are. It has been. We've now dispensed with it. One of the things that the president alluded to in his State of the Union address was the possibility of renegotiating it and bringing inside the circle the Chinese. Peter Husey's mentioned that they have had no interest in getting into that sort of set of constraints. What's your reading on where the Russians are in terms of translating their violations of the INF Treaty into real military capabilities, to say nothing of what the Chinese are doing, unconstrained by it altogether?
Yeah, I had a piece on this. The Trump administration withdrew from the treaty, announced February 2nd that the six-month process of pulling out of the INF Treaty would begin, and gave the vapors to all of the pro-arms control advocates, which are renewing their calls, by the way, for the global zero and no first use nuclear policies, again, to try and disarm the United States. But the INF Treaty was concluded back in 87, and it removed a whole class of missiles, those with ranges from 300 to 3,400 miles. And unfortunately, the Russians violated it, and it was not a new violation. It was a violation that had been underway since 2004. And the Obama administration completely ignored it, tried to hide it, again, on the grounds that they didn't want to upset this arms control relations with the Russians. But finally, it came out. Pressure from Congress mostly forced them to admit that a new ground-launched cruise missile had not only been developed, tested, but deployed in significant numbers to threaten Europe. And so this is the reason that they've pulled out of the treaty. I had a piece this week from the U.S.-China Commission, the Congressional China Commission, with a report explaining that the Chinese were playing a double game on arms control. On the one hand, opposing the U.S. withdrawal from the INF Treaty, but at the same time making clear that Beijing had no interest in any agreements or even negotiations that would limit its intermediate range missiles, of which there are numerous types.
The old heads I win, tails you lose model of Chinese diplomacy, I guess. Bill, when you talk about China, of course, there are numerous facets to the Chinese threat, ballistic missiles, including some that would be within intermediate range, being just one of the vectors they're pursuing. You've been doing some tremendously important reporting on artificial intelligence, or AI, and ways in which the Chinese are weaponizing the developments they've been making, the progress they've been making in the AI space. I remember an important piece you had a couple of months ago about swarming underseas weapons that would benefit from this kind of technology. What else are they up to that we know of, and what are the implications?
Yeah, this is a real significant issue. Artificial intelligence, or AI, is the cutting edge of coming military technology. And I obtained a translation of a Chinese military report from the PLA Daily that was just published last month. And it was done by a officer of the National Defense University named Li Minghai. And he revealed really the outlines of Chinese military plans on how to weaponize artificial intelligence. They're not thinking about self-driving cars and those kinds of things. They're thinking about what this expert called warfighting superiority, using what they said was a logarithm competition. That is, developing weapon systems that are both autonomous and handled by humans, and combining the two in order to make rapid strikes, rapid effects on the battlefield. And so this was a fairly detailed look at future warfare and what the Chinese are planning to do. The U.S. is also doing that, but we haven't heard very much about the Pentagon's plan, other than that they're very focused on artificial intelligence.
Yeah, well, they better be, that's for sure. Bill, one of the other things that they're focusing on, of course, is the very unsettled situation in Latin America at the moment as a result of Venezuela's turmoil. You had testimony from the Southern Commander earlier this week, I believe. Tell us a bit about what we are being told our options are there and what the military might be expected to do.
You know, this is a cutting-edge story right now. The commander of the U.S. Southern Command, who is responsible for U.S. power projection in Latin America, testified before the Senate Armed Services Committee yesterday, on Thursday. And Admiral Craig Fowler testified that the situation is dire. The U.S. Has recognized the leader of the parliament, Juan Guaido, as the legitimate president in a bid to unseat the leftist Cuban-backed and Russian and Chinese-backed dictator Maduro. And so this is really a standoff. Fowler said basically that there were two elements in Venezuela that he described as the center of gravity. Now, in military terms, the center of gravity is your main target in a war, whether it's an information war or a hot war. And the two centers of gravity are the Venezuelan military, which remains firmly in control at the upper levels by Cuban mercenaries, specifically security and intelligence personnel, sent to keep Maduro in power. However, the military has remained in its barracks. They haven't come out. We haven't seen large-scale military action against the massive pro-democracy and anti-Maduro protests that have been underway now on a regular basis. And again, the second center of gravity is these 27,000 Cuban military and intelligence personnel that are propping up this regime.
Right. Literally.
Yeah. When it comes to China and Russia, there have been providing diplomatic support. And in fact, Admiral Fowler even mentioned that the Chinese have been doing some type of cyber activities in support of the Maduro regime. And the reason that the Russians and Chinese are backing Maduro is that they've loaned the Chinese $62 billion, which they have the potential to lose if he goes down. And the Russians, it's about $17 billion.
They've loaned the Venezuelans.
Yes. And so this is a very fluid situation, and it came with a warning from Fowler that certainly got a lot of attention in the media, which was basically any attacks against Americans, and there are about 47,000 Americans in Venezuela, many of them dual nationals, that any violence against them would bring a U.S. military response. In other words, he made clear if they start using military force against unarmed protesters that there could be military intervention a la Panama back in the Noriega days.
Wow. Well, this is going to be, as you say, a cutting-edge story here for a bit, and we'll be following it with you. Thank you for your quick précis of it, Bill. Let me ask you finally about a story that you were covering earlier this week that's quite salacious, I guess, in almost every sense of the word. But it also has some interesting and potentially troubling security implications. Talk about Jeff Bezos of Amazon and the Washington Post fame, Bill, and what we're learning about security problems in his world and the possibility that that might be a problem for the U.S. government, which has seen fit to contract with him for secure information technologies.
Yeah, this is an important security story, although most of it's been in the political realm. This was the lead item of my Washington Times Inside the Ring column this week, and it basically raised the question, does the world's richest man, who has extensive defense contracts, does he have a communication security problem? We've seen the National Enquirer obtained private text messages between Bezos and his mistress, which led Bezos to announce he was divorcing his wife. And I raised the question, well, this is a huge security problem, considering that Bezos is in line for a $10 billion, Amazon is, $10 billion contract at the Pentagon to create something called the Joint Enterprise Defense Infrastructure. Amazon Web Services was initially awarded the contract, and several competitors are now suing because they feel that it was somehow not a fair bidding process. But this raises the question, if the the head guy of Amazon can't protect his communications, how can Amazon, the company that he started and run, protect vital defense secrets as part of its cloud computing services? Also, the Air Force Special Operations Command and many federal agencies are reliant on those Amazon Web Services, their cloud computing services. So this is an important issue.
Yeah, important and likely to become more so as time goes on here, Bill Gertz. You understand extraordinarily well with your expertise in information warfare and technologies that we allow our own systems to be penetrated at our extreme peril. And I'm hopeful that this is a cautionary tale to the military about the Amazon contracts and more generally the importance of not relying on people who may in fact be less rigorous about operation and information security than is needed for certainly our military's purposes. Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk about. We'll look forward to doing so with you again next week. In the meantime, God bless you, my friend. Come back to us soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Michael Cutler, a veteran of the Immigration and Naturalization Services for some 30 years, a man who put his life and his energies towards protecting our interior as well as border security. He has, as a result, a wealth of knowledge and expertise about matters involving immigration issues, of course, and specifically the topics that are so much in the news at the moment, where it comes down to the morality or immorality of border protections and the degree to which we have a real threat to our border as well as the interior of the United States. It's always a privilege to be able to catch up with him. He is, among other things, the star of his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour, which can be found on Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio. But we're always delighted to have him here at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Good to speak with you. Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Well, you did an interesting bit of forensic research the other day that caught my eye, and I wanted to draw you out on it, Michael. The worldwide threat briefing to the United States Congress by the intelligence community has come in for some controversy, including from my friend Fred Flights. But you found that there was some very interesting information in there that reinforced and confirmed the president's admonitions that we have a real threat to our border. Talk a little bit about it.
Sure, absolutely. This is one of many hearings, by the way. You know, I've been before. I think we're up to 17 congressional hearings in the House and Senate myself. Although with the way I've been going after the issues, I don't know that I'll be getting any more invitations, and that's fine. This is about telling the truth. This is about protecting America. And you wonder why they have the hearings if no one's going to heed the advice that comes out of the hearings. And so last week, the Senate Intelligence Committee called upon the members of the intelligence community, the heads of the FBI, CIA, the overall director of national intelligence, and others. And they went list by list, item by item, the threats we face as a nation around the world. And what was interesting, and I think it was on page 18, if I'm not mistaken, they talked about the transnational gangs, the Mexican drug cartels, the Colombian drug cartels, or human traffickers. These are immigration-related issues, specifically. They also, by the way, made note of Iran. And what was interesting about Iran was in April of last year, the Homeland Security Subcommittee in the House on Terrorism and Intelligence did a hearing about how Hezbollah is working in conjunction with human traffickers and drug smugglers throughout Latin America to flood America with drugs for the sake of money and to destroy our society. And it's doing a good job of that, isn't it? And also to bring in people and among them sleeper agents. So when you put all of that mosaic together, what you see is a clear need to secure the United States borders and enforce the immigration laws from within the interior, by the way, as well as along the border. Interior enforcement is always underrated, downplayed, and there's a reason. immigration lawyers, and you have immigration lawyers on both sides of the aisle, don't want agents who are going to be out there deporting their clients. They want this delivery system to keep on. But with that delivery system, we're getting terrorists, we're getting drugs, we're getting members of gangs, and we're getting a lot of carnage. In fact, that Intelligence Committee found, or the report that the Intelligence Committee listened to and reviewed, stated that over 70,000 people died last year of opiate overdoses, and that doesn't include the violent crimes that are committed to feed the drug habits or the crimes committed by the drug cartels as well in the United States. So this is carnage. How in the world do you then not want that border secure?
Yeah. Michael Cutler, one of the entities that is very actively taking advantage of the porousness of our southern border to bring in a drug known as fentanyl is Communist China. And we hear that, well, it's all just coming through ports of entry, therefore this isn't something that speaks to the question of securing the border. In your experience with the Drug Enforcement Agency and INS and so on, where does the truth lie here? Does having a secure border matter in terms of drugs like fentanyl? And how specifically does having the border secured facilitate doing a better job at the ports of entry, if indeed that's where most of this stuff is coming across?
Well, you know, it's about interpretation. When I was on with Neil Cavuto not long ago, and by the way, this issue of drugs, you know, I spent half my 30 years with the INS, assigned first to DEA intelligence for 4 years, and then I was promoted to senior special agent and assigned to the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, and they wanted immigration agents on board because, again, of this nexus between foreign national smuggling and so forth. There's a clear nexus to be drawn. When I was on with Neil Cavuto, he said, well, if there's fewer Border Patrol arrests, that means there's fewer illegal aliens. We can measure border security that way. I said, no, it's a bad metric. That's like taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hand. The better metric is the price and availability of heroin and cocaine, because we don't produce a single gram of those poisons inside the United States. So every gram here is smuggled in. Now, the question is, how is it smuggled in? It's smuggled in through international airports and seaports, but a lot of it is coming across the Mexican border. And I find it remarkable that the globalists of the Democratic Party want to make the point that, well, we're just going to secure the port of entry because they're smuggling it in trucks. They are also smuggling drugs and aliens in a way where they evade the inspections process between ports of entry. And that's where this wall that the president wants is so significant. You know, the Democrats and the globalists have gotten us to change our language. This started with Jimmy Carter. It's Orwellian. There's nothing politically correct about it. These aren't undocumented aliens. Aliens who run the border are uninspected. And in fact, that was the term we used as immigration agents, EWI, entrant without inspection. They're trespassing. They're entering surreptitiously. And we don't know what we don't know. We don't know how much isn't caught. So when we look at the statistics about what is caught, yes, a lot is caught at ports of entry. But how many loads of drugs get through that are undetected and make their way into the United States? Because America has a voracious appetite for drugs. I also find it astonishing that there's no concerted effort of public relations, of commercials, public service announcements to warn people about the dangers of drugs the way we've seen with cigarettes.
Right. Well, to the contrary, we're now opening the doors of big business to marijuana to get people hooked up.
By the way, China is important. And I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine about China and their aggressions. They're sending us fentanyl. They commit intellectual property theft. They spy on us. They hack our computers. And we've been training their students here. They're engineering students. They're programmers. President Trump is finally pushing back. And all we hear out of Wall Street is, well, this trade battle is going to cost us in profits. Our survival is on the line. Let's remember that China is a totalitarian communist country. That has to be underscored.
Yeah, indeed. Let me ask you quickly, Michael, about what's going on at the moment with this congressional negotiation to try to resolve the disagreement between the Democrats, who don't want any borders security, as best I can tell, and the president. There's talk about a DACA deal and other sort of forms of amnesty as sweeteners. What are you hearing and what do you expect?
I'm not hearing anything at this point. What I'm hopeful is that they will hang tough on DACA and all these others. The porosity of that border is dangerous. What the Democrats are saying is, let's make it a smart border, is baloney. You know, someone emailed me and said that the wall was dumb. I said wheels and walls are equally dumb, but both work. You see, you don't need high tech. In fact, the high tech would allow the aliens in, and once they're here, they're detected, they yell political asylum, they're home free, which is exactly what the Democrats want. The wall would keep them out. The president needs to stand tough on the wall. As for DACA, it was an illegal runaround to get past legislation that couldn't get enacted by Congress. First, it was comprehensive immigration reform. It was rebranded as the DREAM Act, supposedly involving children, but these kids could now be as old as 38 years of age under DACA. That's crazy. So I hope the president hangs tough. I hope DACA is not part of the mix. And I hope that the American people will get involved and contact their elected representatives and demand that we safeguard America, because border security is national security. The 9/11 Commission made that point abundantly clear.
One of the other things that is, of course, being discussed, and the president has made a pretty strong signal that he intends to go there if this deal-making process doesn't produce desired results, is to use the military to secure the border. This is something that was pointed out to me that, you know, for most of the history of our country, it was required to do.
Article 4, Section 4 gives the president the authority. Well, Article 4, Section 4, the state shall be protected from invasion.
Right.
And so clearly this constitutes an invasion, I would strongly suggest.
Yeah, I concur. What do you think are his options, and what do you think he's going to do with respect to them?
Well, you can see what he's doing now. He's sending more troops down there, and he's giving some interesting orders. They're not allowed to make arrests because of posse comitatus, but the troops, from what I've been reading in the papers, have been told that if they witness border patrols being attacked, they can use force to support the border patrol. This is new, and I agree with it. In fact, my argument is you come across with an armored vehicle with drugs, as we've heard happen, that should be target practice for our military, as far as I'm concerned. All joking aside, this is a threat to national security. The drug money, by the way, doesn't just fund the cartels. It's funding Hezbollah and other international terrorist organizations. It's incredible to me that you have a party and politicians who took an oath, who put partisan politics ahead of national security and American lives, because that's exactly what we're witnessing today.
Yeah. Well, and there is no question, really, if as has been pointed out, if these were Republican voters who were coming across that border.
You know, we keep hearing about how the Democrats are importing cheap voters. Okay, fine. But do you realize that as you destroy the wage structure of the middle class, which is also one of the things happening with open borders and so forth, you're pushing American families and voters to the left. Americans increasingly are losing the ability to be financially solvent. And the party that promises them the freebies are the Democrats. So by pushing America into poverty, which is what they're trying to do, you're pushing American voters to vote for the party that promises you assistance.
Michael Cutler, thank you for your clarity on these issues. Come back to us again soon, Michael, if you will.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to have an old friend and former colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Kyle Scheidler, in the house, well, virtually, if you will. These days, he is the director of the Counter-Islamist Grid at counterislamist.org. It is a project of the Middle East Forum, which earlier this week was among the co-sponsors of a rather important panel or a series of panels in a program concerning the nation of Qatar. And it's a subject on which Kyle Scheidler is a duty expert, certainly for us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and I think for many in America. It's a delight to have him back to talk a little bit about what was the subject of the focus, the insights of this program that MEF and others put on, about Qatar, which is widely thought of as an American ally, and yet it appears in a whole host of areas is very much something else altogether. Kyle Scheidler, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. So good to have you.
Frank, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, good. Let's talk talk a little bit about Qatar. This is a nation, of course, in the Persian Gulf that is at odds with the Saudis and others in the Gulf Cooperation Council, aligned with Iran and Turkey, and yet the host of a very important U.S. military facility in the region. Give us a flavor of what you all exposed in the course of this important conversation earlier this week.
Well, at the conference, what our participants were really focusing on was how is it that Qatar, which is this country of, I mean, it has something like 300,000 citizens. It's smaller than most American cities. It exhibits such massive influence on the world stage. I mean, if you look at where Qatar is, they are involved in everything. Now, part of that is petrol, oil wealth, right? But it's also their very skillful use of soft power through outlets like Al Jazeera, which they broadcast propaganda, and through their use of Islamist networks like the Brotherhood networks, the Muslim Brotherhood networks that exist throughout the West and throughout the Middle Eastern countries. During the Arab Spring, they became locked in a very serious conflict with their neighbors, most notably Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, because the Qataris were using these Islamist networks, both violent groups and also nonviolent or political Islamist groups, in order to try to overthrow a number of Arab states. They did this successfully in Egypt. They did this successfully in Libya. They were attempting to do this in Syria before things went bad. Now, of course, this was happening to a certain extent with the connivance of the Obama administration, which had been convinced that, you know, democracy in the Middle East led by Islamist parties was the wave of the future. So but Qatar was sort of the man on the ground who had the connections, and they had the money, and they had the ability to influence behavior. And what we've seen is that they've grown to the point now where they're very boldly interfering with the politics of all number of areas. You know, one of the things we talked about at the conference was how the Qataris used hacking and bribery to secure their bid for the FIFA World Cup, for example. So they are a very small country that has gotten very, very bold because of the way that they skillfully use influence and the way they use cover by pretending to be an American ally and pretending to be a resource for America, that they feel secure in the worst kind of bad behavior because they can always say, we have an airbase and we help you bomb the bad guys that we are also funding.
There's a character that you, I know, have spent a lot of time focusing in on, Kyle Scheidler, that plays a prominent role with the Muslim Brotherhood, with the government of Qatar, with its sovereign wealth fund, notably its use of Sharia-compliant finance as an instrument for advancing its, well, Sharia supremacist agenda. His name is Yousef Al-Qaradawi. Tell us a bit about him, what he does there in Qatar, and this curious development recently with respect to Interpol and a red notice about Qaradawi.
So Yousef Al-Qaradawi is a fascinating figure to me, Frank, in part because he is one of the original OGs, if you will, an original gangster of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is a contemporary of Sayyid Qutb, very famous Muslim Brotherhood thinker. He was, you know, trained directly under Hassan al-Banna in the 1940s. So he is a very, you know, he is a very serious thinker of the Muslim Brotherhood. And when he was expelled from Egypt during the crackdown under Nasser against the Muslim Brotherhood, he goes to Qatar. And he has lived in Qatar ever since. He has Qatari citizenship. Now, at the time he went to Qatar, Qatar was essentially a backwater, just coming off being a British protectorate. They have no real infrastructure, especially no religious education infrastructure, nothing significant the way Egypt had Al-Azhar University, the way Saudi Arabia had various universities. And so Qaradawi is in a position essentially to build Qatar's institutions from the ground up, which he helps them do. He plays a very prominent role in their religious education. He plays a very prominent role in their banking sector now as an advisor, as you said, for various sovereign wealth and Sharia finance funds. So he is really at the center of the Qatari nervous system because of this intellectual role that he plays.
Yeah, intellectual and spiritual role as well, I think it's important to say.
And as he is doing this, he is also participating in a Muslim Brotherhood project, which they call the Fiqh of Minorities, that is the jurisprudence of minorities. And the idea is creating the intellectual and religious landscape for Muslim minorities in the West in terms of how they respond to various issues under Sharia. And so this is keeping with creating various institutions so that Muslims in the West can receive fatwas on various things, that is religious information and instructions and so on. And Qaradawi is creating all of this infrastructure. So the Brotherhood through Qaradawi is creating the undergirding superstructure for a lot of the influential elements of Muslim life in the West. We see this in Europe through the European Council for Fatwa and Research. We even see this to a certain extent in the United States. What is Qaradawi's goal? Well, he says explicitly in 1996 at a meeting in Toledo, Ohio, of the Muslim Arab Youth Association, MAYA, he says the goal is conquest through dawah, that is proselytization and recruitment and indoctrination. So this is the network that Qaradawi builds, and Qatar is positioned to take advantage of all of it. And we've seen that especially so post-Arab Spring.
I am so appreciative of your emphasis on this because I think one of the things that has generally been overlooked, I mean, there's a lot of confusion about the Muslim Brotherhood and its character in the West in particular. And you've done a yeoman job in your various incarnations over the years, Kyle Scheidler, including notably two books that you published with us at the Center for Security Policy, Ikhwan in America, An Oral History of the Muslim Brotherhood in Their Own Words, and Care is Hamas, documenting the history, the legacy, the pedigree, if you will, of one of the preeminent Muslim Brotherhood organizations in the United States, the Council on American Islamic Relations. But this idea of sort of the spiritual leaders in the Muslim community and the extent to which the Fiqh Council, as it's called, is a very formidable means of imposing discipline on the Muslim community and assuring conformity with basically the Brotherhood's and others Sharia supremacist dictates is not to be underestimated, is it?
No, and I think it gets to a question that a lot of people ask. You know, when we talk to whether we talk to legislators or just the general public, they say, well, you know, isn't it the case that, you know, a lot of Muslims came to America to get away from a lot of this business? The answer to that is yes. But how is it that we are still stuck with these same Muslim Brotherhood types that are ruling in Qatar, influencing things here in America? And the answer is infrastructure. They built the institutions. And so people in this country, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, who don't want to be led by those institutions, have an uphill battle.
An uphill battle, even perhaps understanding the full complexity of the challenge that we're facing. This is where your work at the Middle East Forum, Kyle Scheidler, is so appreciated. Thank you for your work. Keep it up. I know you will. And come back to us again very soon.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.